We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. When the United States Supreme Court ruled against segregation in public schools, white Southerners resisted. But they knew, ultimately, a very direct approach, one that spoke directly to issues of race, was bound to fail. So our guest for this hour, historian Nancy McLean, says they embarked on what turned out to be a much longer-term project, one that involved promoting the idea of freedom over the idea of equality. This morning, we'll be talking with Nancy McLean, she's professor of history at Northwestern University, about how opposition to integration in public education gave rise to the modern school voucher movement, something she has been thinking about and working with for some time now. She'll be on the campus of the University of Illinois today to talk about this very thing in the talk titled Marketplace Solutions, Segregationists, and the Surprising History of School Vouchers. That's this afternoon at 3:30 in room 223 of Gregory Hall. Her lecture is being sponsored by the Department of History and the Center for a Multiracial Democracy. She is talking with us this morning by telephone, and of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Calls are welcome. We ask people to be brief so that we can get as many callers as possible and be on topic. But other than that, questions are welcome. Our guest, Nancy McLean, is professor of history and African-American studies at Northwestern University. She's interested in African-American women's and labor history. Her most recent book is titled Freedom is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace. That was published by Harvard University Press, 2006, which takes a look at the role that the quest for better jobs played in all modern movements of equality, including civil rights movements for African Americans, Mexican Americans, and also the women's movement. And again, questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor McLean, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for
talking with us. Thank you for having me.
And I know it just I want to make sure that I also mention this too, because I know that you've been this subject, school origins of school vouchers, something I know that you've been interested in and working on for a while. It at some point this is going to be a book?
Yes.
But you're not that close to saying when?
Well, I need probably another leave year to write it.
No.
So and that's not going to come for a few years, but it'll probably come out about 2012.
Okay. Well, eventually there will be a book. And I know this is something that you have been talking about for a while and giving presentations on. So, and I'm sure that folks here would be interested in.
Yes.
In hearing what you have to say. Well, just maybe the place to start would be just to remind people again, refresh their memories about Brown v. Board of Education, because that's really sort of the starting point for all of this.
Brown versus Board of Education was, of course, the Supreme Court decision of 1954, spring 1954, that outlawed school segregation in public schools. And it was actually in some ways a decision that came from a long series of victories that civil rights activists, in particular led by the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, they'd been winning a number of court cases from the 1930s forward. So in some ways, it was a culmination of earlier victories, but it was also something that really came as a shock to the defenders of segregation in the South. I mean, they believed that their system would last essentially forever, and really did not anticipate such a sweeping, unanimous decision from the Supreme Court. So there was actually a kind of shock that spread through the region among supporters of segregation in the first months after the decision, and there wasn't actually that much of a hostile reaction. There was almost a sense that, well, okay, this is the highest court in the land, you know, we're going to have to go along with this. And, of course, there was, there were efforts to to contain the scale of desegregation and to limit it in various ways. But there was an initial sentiment of supporting compliance. What really changed that was an agitational campaign by one of the people that I will talk about today, a man named James Jackson Kilpatrick, who was the editor of the Richmond News Leader, a very important Virginia newspaper. And Kilpatrick began really agitate the whole South against implementation of Brown versus Board of Education. And to do that, he actually resuscitated 19th century doctrines from pro-slavery theorists like John C. Calhoun, arguing that states had the right to interpose their authority against the federal government, and therefore that the United States was really still a compact of states, and so that states didn't have to abide by decisions with which they disagreed. And it was that agitation from Kilpatrick that produced what was called massive resistance, which was a campaign that spread throughout the South, particularly the Deep South, to really resist implementation of Brown tooth and nail. And I think that's really important for us to think about, because it isn't the case that there was kind of an inevitable, furious reaction. This reaction was actually produced by agitation from people like Kilpatrick, who ended up becoming one of the spokespeople for the modern conservative movement. This work that he did in organizing against Brown versus Board of Education brought him to the attention of William F. Buckley, who had just in 1955 launching the National Review magazine, which became kind of the organizing center of the new conservative movement. And the National Review and Buckley helped bring Kilpatrick to a national audience. So what you saw there was a real fusion between the Southern segregationist cause, which was also the most vehement exponents of which were really serious conservatives, and this Northern, actually New York-based conservative movement that was taking off at the same time. So my story really follows that and shows the kind of learning process that went on as they figured out how to try to defend power in this new environment created by Brown versus Board of Education.
Yes, and just for those people who say that name sounds vaguely familiar, this is James J. Kilpatrick, as someone who has had a long career as a political commentator. If one is old enough, they'll remember the segment that he was involved in on the program 60 Minutes a long time ago. It's that James J. Kilpatrick, who did the point counterpoint from the conservative side, was someone who was well known as a conservative political commentator, but I think probably a lot of people would not recognize the fact that he has backed off from this, but early in his life, he was a very strong supporter of segregation, and that was really what launched his career as political commentator.
Exactly. And I think I think that the language I would use is even stronger than supporter of segregation. He was actually kind of the agitator who galvanized people across the South to resist Brown. And what I found in my archival research in Kilpatrick's papers and those of other Southern pro-segregation activists is that he and some of the people that I'll talk about today were really going around the South and actually meeting with governors and meeting with legislators and really at first trying to get them to resist Brown outright, you know, kind of in defense of segregation and states' rights. And then as the court began to say, you know, various courts at various levels began to say that, you know, they could no longer do that, then they began to look for other ways of defending exclusion and defending the kind of, you know, the privileges that existed for whites before that, and that's when they happened on school vouchers. So it's really an interesting story. I mean, they did not immediately kind of jump to vouchers, but it was, again, this learning process of realizing that, you know, in the wake of Brown, these racial commitments could not speak their name. So they had to find alternative ways to do that. And one of the people who was really central in this was a man I'll talk about this afternoon named Leon Durr, who was a former Washington Post correspondent, who started to say things like, freedom is the answer. The marketplace is the solution to all our problems. And what he was getting at is the way in which by taking decision-making out of the public realm, you know, away from democratic processes and putting it in the market, they could avoid the democratizing consequences of changes going back even to the 1930s and the New Deal and the kind of more robust, social citizenship that, you know, first industrial workers got from the New Deal in the 1930s, and then that African Americans began to get with the Civil Rights Movement. So in a lot of ways, it's a much larger story, and what most interests me in it is this is understanding the origins of the contemporary push to privatization. So I think, you know, looking at it as a kind of learning process in which people had to find other ways of defending interests and privileges that were endangered by democratic institutions is really, really kind of a key to doing that.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Nancy McLean. She's a professor of history at Northwestern University. We're talking about some of the work that she's done, looking at the origins of the modern school voucher movement in as part of the response in the South to the desegregation order of the Supreme Court in 1954, Brown v. Board of Education. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that part of the story that's interesting, or something that really makes this interesting, is that it seems to me that so much of the coverage of Brown v. Board is about the sort of the landmark status of the decision and its implications, and then its implications over the long term. And I think people certainly have justly asked question of what, how much has changed or how much hasn't changed. And I think that though then in a lot of the coverage and discussion of the decision itself, at least to me, it seems that there hasn't been quite as much attention paid to the fact that there was resistance, that it certainly did not go smoothly. It was not implemented without any problems, and that we do have something like, for example, this massive resistance movement in the South, where there were places where white Southerners said, well, rather than have our white children go to school with black children, we're simply going to close the schools. And they did that, and there were places that the schools remained closed for years for that very reason.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually one of the stories that I'll be talking about today is the case of Prince Edward County, Virginia, where the public schools were entirely shut down for 5 years from 1959 to 1964 in order to prevent implementation of Brown. And what's really interesting about there's many things that are interesting and moving about what happened in Prince Edward County, but for purposes of understanding the origins of the push for privatization, what's interesting is that it's the first modern case of the adoption of school vouchers in order to escape having integrated schooling. And so what the County Board of Supervisors did in Prince Edward County was entirely shut down the public school system and then take public monies and public resources to create a private school system that for the white students. And for 5 years, 1,800 black children were entirely deprived of any form of public education. So the only education they were able to get was what was provided through a pretty amazing and ingenious kind of ad hoc support network coming from black churches, from the American Friends Service Committee had representatives in Prince Edward County for 5 years trying to help support that. But basically, black students were completely locked out of public education. And there again, I mean, the hand of Kilpatrick in this conservative movement was considerable. I mean, he was in touch with the county officials and the editor of the local newspaper, the Farmville Herald, throughout this time. And the library facilities in the Prince Edward Academy, the segregationist academy that was set up for white students, the library is actually named after Kilpatrick because he was so central to this struggle that the segregationists were waging. But so what I have found in the research for this is that Prince Edward County conflict became the kind of crucible through which these conservatives who wanted to defend segregation learned that they could not do so in a racially explicit way. So again, they begin to learn about vouchers and they begin to discover resources elsewhere in the country. So for example, they discover Milton Friedman, the libertarian economist who published his first piece advocating school vouchers in 1955, the year after Brown versus Board of Education. And he was actually challenged on that by the liberal economist editor, Bob Solo, of the publication in which he placed the article. And he was challenged because Solo could see that this was going to be used by, that this was going to fuel the efforts of Southerners to use vouchers in private schools to escape desegregation. And when challenged on it, you know, Friedman thought a bit and then said, well, you know what, I hate forced non-segregation. I hate racism, but I hate forced non-segregation as much as I hate forced segregation. So he basically kind of gave his blessing to this effort to create private schools in the South, and thus began his own lifelong quest to privatize public education. And that's actually going to be a big part of the story that I tell in the book, because he was active for 50 years in promoting this, and he was actually the one who linked up the Southerners to, for example, Northern Catholics who were trying to get public monies for parochial education, to religious conservatives who were trying to escape the public school system because of the outlawing of school of prayer in the schools and so forth. So there's a lot of alliance building going on in these years. And what I found in my research in Friedman's papers in the Hoover Institution out in California is that he was really at the center of this in a way I did not realize when I embarked on this project. Mm-hmm. But he was, you know, continually working to totally privatize public education.
Yeah. One thing I think I would try to be, I mean, myself, I would try to be clear about it, and I think that you would too, is in talking about this as being the maybe the beginning of what we would say would be the modern voucher movement, because it's my understanding that the idea of vouchers goes back some way in America, but that what it was intended to do was it was used in places where, say, you had a town where they didn't have a school, so it was a way for people to say, okay, here we're going to give you some money, and now you can go to the neighboring town to go to school because we don't have a school here. How did the people who clearly had this intent of maintaining segregation in education, Where did they even get the idea of doing this? And I suppose further the question would be, well, how did they represent what they were doing in a way that wouldn't make it quite so obvious what they were doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that there were earlier vouchers, particularly in the 19th century, in a number of more, as you say, more rural areas, in various parts of New England, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire, et cetera, where there weren't kind of large enough population groups to have, as you say, to support a public school system. There were these voucher programs. So the idea was out there in some ways. In terms of the Southerners who begin to adopt this, that also I think becomes kind of an interesting story, because what I've found in this research is that I think sometimes we think maybe a bit too simplistically about this history and imagine that the only thing that's motivating these Southern elite segregationists is a commitment, is kind of racism. And certainly that was really an important part of it. But what I found in really looking deeper into this story and going to the sources is that these were the same people who began to break with Roosevelt, with Franklin Roosevelt, and with the Democratic Party in the later part of the 1930s, because they saw the New Deal as becoming too democratic, as doing too much for workers, as putting too many restraints on business, you know, as building a social welfare state that they opposed. And so really there's a very, very strong line of continuity between that turning against the New Deal in the late 1930s and what we see in the story that I'm focusing on in the 1950s. And, you know, just for example, I mean, some of the Virginia leaders who were very involved in fighting Brown v. Board of Education were people like Harry Byrd, who was a longtime U.S. senator, and Howard Smith, who was a longtime Virginia congressman. And these are the guys who were leading the resistance to the New Deal from the late 30s, you know, on. And so they really linked those causes. And perhaps this is a long-winded answer to what you just asked, but basically the language of opposition to a New Deal state, to a social welfare state, to an activist government is very useful for fighting desegregation without relying on explicit white supremacy. So that's essentially what happens, is this language of states' rights, of property rights, you know, employers' rights, et cetera, becomes the popular language for spreading the gospel of resistance to Brown versus Board of Education, because many of, for example, the northern conservative Catholics that the Southerners that I'm writing about, the Catholics that they ally with, many of them really didn't want to be associated with racism and were leery of coalition with people who were outright segregationists, but they were very reassured by a language that said, no, this is about property rights, it's about parental rights, it's about, you know, supporting the states against federal power grabs, et cetera. There's a kind of, at least a facially kind of racially neutral language that the conservative movement develops that is reassuring to people who have questions about the older kind of white supremacist defenses of segregation.
And maybe just to make, in case anybody's drawing the connection, maybe we also should say that this man, this Virginia Senator Harry Byrd, mm-hmm. who was involved with the massive resistance movement, is no relation to current Senator Robert Byrd.
True, but Robert Byrd also has an interesting history.
Well, yes. Yeah, I don't mean in case, because I had that, you know, when I was reading just a little bit about Harry Byrd, that was my first question. I thought, Harry Byrd, is Robert Byrd related to him? No, Robert Byrd is not.
Yeah.
Another thing
that's very interesting about, to me, of course, since I'm working on it, I think there are lots of interesting things, but I really see the fight against Brown versus Board of Education as being the crucible that really gave rise to the push for what gets called judicial originalism or original intent jurisprudence, the mm-hmm. kind of legal thinking advocated by justices such as Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas and the Federalist Society and Enwin Meese. All of that really develops in the reaction to Brown versus Board of Education, and again also in the reaction to the late New Deal in 1937. But there's a way in which the advocates of that that position have kind of created an immaculate conception story for themselves, you know, that as though they really just got going in the wake of, say, Roe versus Wade and the abortion decisions of the 1970s. But if you actually look at the sources, all of the arguments that are being, you know, that get made for restricting the court to what the founders originally intended, you know, according to these advocates, all of that really gets going in the 1950s in the reaction to Brown v. Board of Education, and it's a very popular cause, you know, in the South, as people look for, again, a kind of a racially neutral language to defend their right to exclusive institutions. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Nancy McLean. She is professor of history and African-American studies at Northwestern University and is interested in African-American women's and labor history. Her most recent book is titled Freedom Is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace, which takes a look at how the quest for better jobs was involved in and important to things like the civil rights movement for African-Americans, for Mexican-Americans, the women's movement. She's here talking with us this morning about something that she has been researching for some time now, that is the origins of school vouchers in the resistance among white Southerners to school integration, and that is the we're talking about the what happened in 1954 with the Brown v. Board of Education decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. By the way, I also wanted to mention that our guest Nancy McLean will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois today, and she'll be giving a talk about this very subject in room 223 Gregory Hall at 3:30 this afternoon, and her talk here is sponsored by both the Department of History and the Center for Multiracial Democracy. Or is that the Center for Democracy and a Multiracial Society? I think I want to make sure I got that right. And questions
actually,
are welcome.
David, could I just jump in there?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Actually, the talk has been moved
to
a different location.
Well, we want to make sure I give the right location.
Yeah. So it's in Levis Hall, which is just looking at my directions here. It's on Lincoln. It's on Illinois Street.
Yes.
Let me try to. It's 919 West Illinois Street. And I think there's an interesting story to the moving of the talk that connects with our topic today, in that the talk was moved in support of kind of solidarity with the graduate employees organization strike.
Yes.
Which was, you know, we didn't know whether the strike would be settled in time for the talk, and so I did not want to cross the picket line because I very much supported what the graduate assistants were seeking, and the history department organizers of the talk also wanted to support the students, and I think it's just such an interesting kind of coincidence that all of this is happening together, because the struggles that we're seeing in public higher education institutions, whether it's the University of Illinois or University of California, where there's also a strike going on against radically increased fees, all of this really comes, to my mind, is rooted in the story that we're talking about here and in this half-century-long conservative campaign against public education at all levels. And actually, I just learned about this from the GEO, the Graduate Students Union on the U of I campus, that this week is a global week of action on the mantra that education is not for sale. So basically, you know, I think all of these things are tying into this situation that we're faced with, in which education at the primary and secondary level and also at the higher education level is increasingly facing pressures to privatize and to take things out of the public and into the private realm. And that is really, really rooted in the story of school vouchers that goes back to Brown versus Board of Education.
All right. Good. Very good. So, again, to mention, make sure that if there are people on the campus who are listening to us who would like to go here, Nancy McLean, Levis, at the Levis Faculty Center. But we're still talking about 3:30 this afternoon.
Yes.
So, very good. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, just to go back and to talk about just what happened immediately in the time that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about people who were fighting segregation. They actually closed the schools in this particular place that you were looking at. So for years, the African-American kids had no schools. They set up private white academies. Then they took public funds and gave them to the parents so they could send their children to the private white academies. It, eventually, though, that was ruled to be illegal, didn't it? Wasn't,
yes.
Was it not?
Yes. 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 It was ruled to be illegal. But at that point, I mean, I think there's a kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it, but a kind of contingency or critical mass situation here, too, in that by the time it was ruled to be illegal, there was such momentum to this private school effort across the South. And it's actually much more the Deep South, the kind of Upper South and the Border South resisted integration more subtly. I mean, they practice token integration, you know, a few students here, a few students there, you you know, bringing a few black kids into white schools, but not any white kids to black schools, et cetera. But the real effort to thoroughly privatize education was much more a phenomenon in Southside Virginia, which is where Prince Edward County is, and in Mississippi, Alabama, South Georgia, et cetera, the kind of old plantation belt. In those communities, the push for private schools continued even after the vouchers were outlawed, and it did so primarily often through conservative Christian schools. So they founded, you know, just there's a surge of construction of conservative Christian academies in the South in the late 50s and 1960s. And when they really take off is after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, when the federal government really gets serious about implementing school desegregation in about 1965, 1966. That's when you see a really big wave of these Christian academies being set up. And again, it's just a story. It's been kind of surprising to me in researching it how many surprising and interesting the connections there are. But, you know, on this particular point, Jerry Falwell, whom we all know as somebody who, you know, opposed abortion and the Equal Rights Amendment and gay rights, well, Jerry Falwell actually had his first political involvement as a supporter of segregation. He was the, in 1957, he was the chaplain of the Virginia, of the Lynchburg, Virginia chapter of the Defenders of State Sovereignty, which was the group behind the Prince Edward County school closures. He was their chaplain. This organization was essentially like the White Citizens Councils, but with a different name because Virginia is always sort of elite and never goes along with others, basically, but it was you know, the equivalent of the White Citizens Councils. And so he makes gives sermons, I should say, not speeches, but a couple of sermons that are really kind of vehemently supporting segregation. And then in 1967, again in the wake of the Civil Rights Act, he sets up the Lynchburg Christian Academy as a Christian school for white students. And so I think, and it was explicitly, you know, for white students initially. And so, again, this is a story that that has many dimensions. And one of those dimensions is its tie to the rise of the Christian right, of the religious right, which really became a resource for segregationists as these conservative evangelical churches oftentimes hosted Christian schools in part in the effort to evade desegregation.
We have a caller. Others, by the way, welcome to join the conversation here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. As we continue to talk with our guest, Nancy McLean, she's professor of history from Northwestern University. We have a caller here in Champaign to bring in, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, as I listened to the discussion, do you see any parallels between what happened then with Brown versus Board of Education and kind of the direction of the conservative movement in terms of us having a first African-American president? And I'll just listen offline.
I see habits of thought and patterns of organizing in the opposition to President Obama that we've seen this year that, yeah, definitely go back to the kind of story I'm telling. And, you know, I want to start by saying that, you know, of course, anybody has a right to take issue with any person in public office or, you know, to debate policies or to disagree or things like that. So I, you know, I'm not saying that at all. And I think some conservatives have rightly said, you know, that you can't just say that any opposition to the president is somehow, you know, racist in motive. But I think, you know, when you look at these demonstrations that have been organized by the conservative movement with the blessing of many Republican members of Congress, and you see the placards and you see the slogans and you hear the interviews with people who are doubting, you know, saying that they still don't believe that the president was born in the United States or is a legitimate citizen. I mean, it all goes back to this, in this sense that that the conservative movement activists developed, that, you know, that they were, in Sarah Palin's words, the real Americans, you know, and that others were somehow interlopers who didn't have the same rights, who didn't have the same claims to inclusion or to legitimacy. And I think, yes, that we are seeing some very, very disturbing things now. And I think it's all the more disturbing in that people who are in responsible positions of leadership in the Republican Party have not only, you know, rarely spoken out against the stuff that's going on at the grassroots, but have in fact sometimes actively incited it. And I find that terrifying, actually, because, you know, we're in a situation where we already know that this president has three times more threats on his life than George Bush did, and where there's a country with a lot of crazy, angry people. And I think the irresponsibility of the conservative media, you know, sort of the Fox News network, and of the Republicans in Congress is creating a really frightening situation in our country. You know, I just think, you know, that the kind of mobs that shut down the healthcare town halls are not a good sign. You know, we are a society that is supposed to be about deliberative democracy, which means that you can disagree vehemently, you know, and make your own case, but to take away other people's right to speak or debate is a very frightening thing. And I'm still waiting to see you know, serious Republicans stand up and speak out about that.
All right. Other questions, again, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just to return to the school voucher story, there's another aspect of this that I think is interesting and maybe one might say ironic. The fact that after this point, when the idea of vouchers spread, and you talked about the fact that white Southerners who really had in mind the idea of continuing for education to be segregated, went out looking for support. They found support among Catholics who were interested in support for religious schools, for Catholic schools, conservative Protestants outside the South who have their own reasons for wanting their own schools because they were concerned about the atmosphere and the values of the public schools, and they didn't want their children there. But the thing that's really interesting is given the fact that the modern voucher movement really grew out of this intense desire to maintain segregated schools. The thing that's really interesting is that today, African Americans are among the strong supporters of vouchers.
Yeah, that's why the talk is, contains the phrase "the surprising history of school vouchers," and I think that is one of the surprising elements, that it's a really complicated story that has evolved significantly over time, so that African Americans now support vouchers, or are three times more likely than whites to support vouchers. And while on the face of that, you know, on the face of this history, that's kind of astonishing, I think if we really consider what's actually happened to education and what African Americans have encountered in education since Brown versus Board of Education, it makes a lot more sense, because this white resistance to equalizing education that was certainly most visible and most talked about in the South, but was also present in the North. I mean, there were white strikes of white parents in New York City, for example, to resist desegregation in the 1960s. And so 50, you know, it's more than 50 years after Brown now, African Americans are still waiting for the equal education that was promised by that decision. And what we've seen instead is a combination of white flight to private schools, in some situations more commonly to suburban schools, where various kinds of zoning laws and whatnot prevent us from having economically integrated and racially integrated schools. And at the same time, very, you know, Supreme Court decisions from the 1970s forward made it impossible to equalize resources between urban and suburban schools, or between suburban and rural schools. That, you know, they've been put, African Americans have been put in an impossible position with failing schools that don't have the resources, that don't have the support. And so I think, you know, in some ways the support for vouchers is almost kind of like an effort at a Hail Mary pass or something, you know, just trying to find some way to finally get decent education for their children. But what's painful to me about this story is not only, you know, realizing that deep frustration of parents who see their kids, you know, futures just getting shut down by poor schools, but also seeing the kind of cynicism, frankly, with which conservative organizers have gone after that. And so one of the things I found in this research is that from essentially about 1980 forward, conservatives realized that they just weren't going to make any real headway with the whites who were voting Republican, who were out in the suburbs, because they were very happy with their schools. They didn't want to change their schools, and they weren't going to support vouchers. And so to find a constituency for vouchers, they had to identify who was most frustrated with public education, and of course that's Black and Latino parents. And so there was actually a quite concerted effort coming from foundations such as the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, the Bradley Foundation, and other leading conservative foundations and think tanks. There was a concerted effort to target African Americans in particular, and also Latinos, for what they called non-traditional alliances. And so they've also begun to put money into that effort. So there's, for example, an organization based in Milwaukee called the Black Alliance for Educational Options, which gets upwards of $4 million worth of funding from conservative foundations to promote vouchers around the not just in Milwaukee but around the country. So it's really kind of a sad picture now, in which, you know, while I can totally understand the desperation of urban, you know, parents in low-income communities trying to get decent education for their kids, at the same time, as a historian, I have this, you know, very clear sense that they're being used pretty cynically in order to advance an agenda which really will hurt their communities in other ways.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Nancy McLean. She's professor of history at Northwestern University. We've been talking about some of the research that she's been doing for some time now about the origins of school vouchers, and she's going to be talking about this. She has traveled various places around the country, shared some of what she learned with other people at other universities, and eventually there'll be a book. But now, if you want to hear about it, and if you're on the campus of the university, she'll be talking about this afternoon at 3:30. And I do want to mention again, I wasn't aware the location had been changed, so I want to make sure I give the correct information. She'll be speaking this afternoon at 3:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus, and I'm sure anyone who is interested in attending should stop by. We do have another caller here to bring into the conversation, someone in Urbana, so let us do that. Line one. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
If I'm reading between the lines of what you've been describing here for the last 40 minutes or so, it sounds as if there's a correlation between predominantly white conservative Christian groups and or Christian churches, conservative Christian churches, and this desire to keep the races apart. Now, what I'm about to say may be tangential. Maybe there's a relationship. I don't know. I remember.
Could I ask you to? I didn't hear the second part. That there's a correlation between predominantly white conservative Christians, and what was the next part?
And the desire to keep the races apart.
Okay.
That way. The reason I bring this up, there may be, this may be tangential, and maybe a subject of further study in the future. I remember seeing a program, I think it was on Frontline or someplace, some news documentary about how many very conservative Christian churches have built these mega churches that you see frequently surrounding a metropolitan area. Champaign has a few of them. Decatur, I've noticed, has even a greater selection. These great crystal Christoramas out in the middle of nowhere that, of course, well beyond any public transport and so on and so forth. And the suggestion has been that part of the reason for doing that is to get away from the inner city, get away from where people of color are living, and therefore keep their congregation, you know, sort of an all-white, middle-class, or at least able to afford the transport to get out there and join the congregation, way of separating one group of people from another. Do you see any correlation of that in this sort of activity and the things you study, or comment on that any way you can, if you can. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think this megachurch phenomenon is very much a kind of feature of our time, and that definitely involves a kind of way of thinking that it's about that builds divisions between sort of the congregants' notions of the saved and the damned, so they do construct kind of parallel universes that provide, you know, not only schools oftentimes, but childcare, job training, networking for employment. You know, it's almost like a kind of a para-state as the American, you know, the broad kind of New Deal welfare state has been scaled back, and people find themselves in need. Many people are finding, you know, one of the only places they can get things they need is from churches. So I think there's a strong connection there. I'm not so sure about the actual construction, you know, whether the construction of these facilities in the suburbs is, intended to cut them off from public transport and people of color that way. I think it's more that, in my sense, at least, that the kind of theology of these groups and their way of thinking about the world leads them to want to construct barriers between themselves and groups that they disdain. And I think, you know, in that, I think that the kinds of moral claims that these churches make in their theology kind of goes together with notions that somehow inner city African Americans are somehow, you know, morally inferior, and so there's a way in which kind of race gets smuggled into, I think, the moral system. But I don't know. I've never seen any information saying that the physical sighting of the churches was designed to escape people of color. I think really maybe another way to think about it is that the sighting of the churches was designed to reach the whites who were maybe part of white flight from the city, so it's kind of more connected perhaps in that way. That's how I think I'd see the connection.
And I suppose maybe if you're going to apply Occam's razor to the problem, you'd say, well, okay, you're going to build a gigantic new building, a big church, an associated building, and you want to have a huge parking lot. Well, you know, wouldn't it make sense to go someplace where there isn't anything already, where you're going to start, where you got bare ground, where all you got to do is scrape it and start building from the ground up? Not to say that maybe those other things don't apply, but I don't know.
Yeah, although I think, you know, there's also an interesting, I mean, the story just gets so sort of complex and interesting in that, you know, one of the biggest transnational forces in today's world is the evangelical missionary enterprise. And what's happening through that missionary enterprise is that many white evangelicals who, you know, kind of came out of this background that we've been talking about here have gone over to try to win recruits and souls in, you know, various parts of Africa and Asia and Latin America. And they've gotten pushback from the people that they're trying to evangelize about their racial views and about our country's foreign policies. And so, you know, it's not by no means a majority movement within these churches yet, but you do see some changes going on that are induced really much more by what's going on overseas with people of color than what's going on at home, so that now there are some churches, some of these mega churches, that actually do pride themselves on diversity. diversity and on particularly recruiting immigrants, new immigrants of color, from Latin America and from Africa and Asia. I think they're less interested in long-term inhabitants of the country, but you do see some of that. I remember reading a very interesting story in the New York Times about a church just outside Atlanta in a predominantly white community that was part of this. So it's very much an evolving and, as the talk title says, surprising history, I think, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take another caller here while we have time. Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to return to Chicago, and I know charter schools is a bit of a digression from the voucher, but I'm sure you have an opinion on it. And I wanted to ask you about something I heard from Ed Policy student, that the Arne Duncan and his turnaround schools, it's really right out of a corporate discourse, turnaround capitalist venture sort of thing, and reconstituting these schools as they're doing up there. And an anecdote that I heard was that this hideous killing of this honor student happened in a neighborhood where there are three schools that were being affected by this these theories, and one of them was becoming a military school. One of them was reconstituted, and they fired 70% of the teachers. And the patterns of the neighborhood were disrupted. And this is clearly not in the way of an excuse for the brutality of that. But it just seems to me that the argument was made that this was was warned against, that you can't just do this kind of intervention without expecting something to happen, and if you don't make provision for it. And so do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I don't know, kind of all the specifics about the schooling reorganization in that area, but I do know that, yet you're absolutely right, that that the violence that occurred there was related to the disruption of previous pattern, kind of neighborhood patterns and schools. And, there are these kind of like gang situations and accommodations in poor communities in today's cities. And what happened there was a combination of the transformation of public housing, which is also a privatization story. All of these major public housing complexes are being dismantled by the city, and people are being scattered to other places, and at the same time they were reorganizing schools. Yeah, and so you had real tensions between students who had kind of come up, it's kind of like sports teams or nations or something, with these senses of kind of turf that were being shuffled between the demise of public housing and, or the dismantling of public housing and the transformation of the schools. And on your larger point about kind of Arne Duncan and the promotion of private schools, I would have to say I was very enthused about President Obama and kind of the fresh air he was bringing, has been bringing on many fronts. But on this issue of public education, I have been very disappointed, actually, to see how much his administration has kind of kowtowed to the people like Duncan, who, as you say, is really associated with this kind of corporate and privatization effort. And what's happening, I think, is that, in all of this stuff, There's no real honest talk about what's actually happening in the communities that have the weakest schools. So you rarely hear people say that, well, golly, we've got concentrated poverty on a scale that has never been seen before in this country, and we've got inequality at a level that has never been seen before in this country, and that's unmatched in the wider world. And, not only are these schools not performing, but the families are devastated. The neighborhoods are devastated. There aren't jobs. They're just so many deep problems that need, attention on many, many fronts. And just privatizing schools or setting up charter schools is not going to be the panacea that we're being promised. It's going to create a whole new series of, disappointments. So I'm very discouraged on that front.
And pardon me for interrupting you. We're at the end, and I have to stop here. Nancy McLean is professor of history at Northwestern. She'll be here talking about the origins of school vouchers this afternoon, 3:30 at Levis Faculty Center, sponsored by the Department of History and the Center for Democracy and a Multiracial Society. Professor McLean, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Programs here are made possible by English Hedgerow, a special event florist, bistro, full-service caterer on the corner of University and Lincoln, Urbana. English Hedgerow delivers distinctive bouquets, plants, gift baskets, and gourmet box lunches throughout the Champaign-Urbana area. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio adjacent to Kemble Hall for public telecommunication. We're going to break for an update on the markets. We'll be back. Stay tuned.